Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with brother and sister David and Margaret Talbot. David founded Salon.com and has written 6 books. Margaret is a staff writer at The New Yorker. And we're going to talk about the new book they've written together about the 1960s, By the Light of Burning Dreams. And you can learn more about the book at HarperCollins.com and about each of their work at The David Talbot Show, all one word, TheDavidTalbotShow.com and MargaretTalbot.com. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, and more, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, Google Play, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Anyone who listens to this show probably knows that my worldview and my take on things are rooted in my experience of what we call the 60s. And I say what we call because for me, it's really sort of 63 to 73, and other people will take it to 75. Other people will start it with Kennedy's election and so on, but the 60s. Those who listen regularly may also know about my vision for a movement that I call 60s 2.0. I believe that some of the best questions, values, and visions of the 60s are alive in millennials and younger today. And I believe they stand a chance of building something deeper and more sustainable this time with the help of technology, demographics, cultural and social evolution, and with a big jump, this part hasn't happened yet, in the meaningful engagement of boomers and older. So I was excited to learn of the new book by today's guest, By the Light of Burning Dreams. In it, they tell the bigger story of the 1960s, an era they call the Second American Revolution, through the individual stories of a number of movement leaders, including Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda, Russell Means and Dennis Banks of the American Indian Movement, Bobby Seale of the Black Panther Party, Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta of the United Farm Workers, Heather Booth and the women behind the Jane Collective Feminist Abortion Network in Chicago, and a couple of others. Whatever you may think of the 1960s, and there's been plenty of hindsight criticism and even scoffing, many of the era's values and concerns have aged pretty well. While the whole Trump phenomenon challenges any assumption of progress, it's still fair to say that in social and cultural realms, 60s attitudes are a part of mainstream culture or on the ascendant. Marijuana is now some form of legal in half the country. An African American was twice elected president. For LGBTQ and the disabled, strides have been huge. Yoga and mindfulness are mainstream. Burning Man, maybe the most celebrated, but prior to the pandemic, music and lifestyle festivals were everywhere. At the same time, I believe the two 60s values that have fared the worst are caring for the planet and economic justice. And along with economic justice, I would throw in racial justice and the whole otherness of people. Why? Follow the money. It is in the narrow and short-term financial interest of wealthy and powerful individuals, corporations, and industries to stall and prevent change in those areas. Despite all the progress in social and cultural terms, we are also failing to fulfill another key 60s value, our sense of community. We lost it one technological innovation, one demographic trend, one geographic shift at a time. Perhaps we didn't notice the gradual loss, but the price we've paid for convenience and mobility is high. We need a rebirth of community, and that presents a huge challenge in a society where our pain, fear, and disappointment fuel tribalism instead. Many of us who took part in the movements of the 60s and 70s felt that we actually were going to revolutionize America. We would bring about racial and economic justice, end U.S. imperialism, reinvent education, unite the working class, and liberate women and gays. 50 years later, inequality is worse. Racial justice is stalled. We face a potentially existential climate crisis, and democracy may be under even greater threat. I know it wasn't all in vain. but what can we learn from the successes and failures of the movements of the 60s? And by the way, this is one of a number of conversations I'm having to learn more about the 60s at this time. A few weeks ago, I talked with Bill McKibben about an organization he has co-founded called Third Act to mobilize boomers and older to join youth in taking on the crises we face. And their first two targets are climate and democracy. I recently spoke with Edward Morgan about his 2010 book, What Really Happened to the 1960s, How Mass Media Culture Failed American Democracy. And then that takes us to today's conversation. David Talbot is a journalist, author, activist, and independent historian. He founded the pioneering online magazine Salon.com, was a senior editor at Mother Jones, and is the author of six books, including The Devil's Chessboard and Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. Margaret Talbot has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2004 and is author of The Entertainer, Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century. Together, they wrote the book we'll talk about today, By the Light of Burning Dreams, The Triumphs and Tragedies of the Second American Revolution. Welcome, David and Margaret Talbot, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Hi, Terry. It's good to be here.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Friday, January 7th. So first of all, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So could each of you tell us a bit about your path to the work you do today? And feel free to go way back, mention moments of inspiration, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing. And you don't have to dwell on your experience of the 60s. We'll get to that in a minute. David, you can go first.
Oh, me first. Okay. Well, thanks, Terrence. And thank you for that analysis of the 60s and both what we accomplished and how we fell short. I think that's reflective of what we, Margaret and I, write about in the book. So thank you for that opening statement. My own path is a long one. I'm 70 years old now. I think I'm only slightly younger than you. I'm older by 10 years than Margaret. And my path began, I think, in Los Angeles when I was in high school. I went to the Harvard Military School at the time.
That's now Harvard Westlake, right?
Harvard Westlake.
Yeah. And not a military school anymore, just for LA listeners. Yep.
Yep. But at the time, very much so, a military school. I wore a uniform every day. Paul Cummins, a very well-known progressive educator in Los Angeles, who later started Crossroads and other alternatives.
And then New Roads. Crossroads ended up becoming an elite school. So he created New Roads, where half the students are on financial aid.
That's right. So Paul, and he's still with us, writing poetry and still active, I know. I just got his latest book of poems. Paul was my mentor. He was head of the English department at Harvard in those years in the 1960s. He was a young progressive who went up against the administration. Father Chalmers was a very strict headmaster of Harvard in those years. He founded Harvard and had made it what it was, sort of the leading prep school in LA. And Paul was the first to fall afoul of the military program during the Vietnam years and Father Chalmers, and was forced out and ended up going to Oakwood, which was another alternative school in the San Fernando Valley. I ended up going a similar path. I butted heads as a senior class president with Father Chalmers. I then appealed to Paul, let me in. I have to graduate from somewhere. No college in America would let me in those years, because he wrote, Father Chalmers, the headmaster at Harvard, to every college saying that I was a, quote, disciplinary risk and I shouldn't be admitted to any college. But Paul Cummins, bless his heart, allowed me to graduate at least from high school. And the only school that would let me in, the only college, was Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz, bless their hearts.
They said, he's a disciplinary problem, let's have him.
That's right. They said, sounds good to us.
We love him. We love those disciplinary problems.
So that was the beginning of my problem with authority, I think. Early on, I from high school on, I thought that authority was corrupt, was on the wrong path, and it needed my generation to correct it. And so I think that's how I started. Margaret was growing up as a kid in those years, and I'll let her take over at this point.
Yeah, well, we grew up in Studio City. I did not go to an elite private school. I went to North Hollywood High School of Go Huskies. So we had a different experience in that way. We actually grew up in the backyard of Harvard Boys School, and that was one reason that both David and our brother Stephen went there. But our father was an actor. The book that you mentioned that I wrote, The Entertainer, is kind of a story about him telling sort of the story of the history of 20th century entertainment through his biography, because he was an older dad. He was 60 when I was born. Wow. And he was born in 1902, and he had kind of a wild ride through American entertainment history, starting as a magician's assistant, having rocks broken on his chest as he toured through little Midwestern towns in the teens, and then early theatrical touring companies through the South and Midwest, and then a leading man at Warner Brothers, making pre-code pictures.
Wait, what was his first name?
His name was Lyle Talbot. In the early 30s, he was, you know, one of these guys who was supposed to be the next Clark Gable or the next this or the next that. He was on the cover of one of the Screen magazines as, you know, the male, the future superstar Lyle Talbot and future female superstar Katharine Hepburn. Didn't really work out that way for various reasons.
But together they have a large total of Oscar nominations.
That's true. Good point. But he was a founder of the Screen Actors Guild. Probably got him in a little bit of trouble, actually, maybe got him blacklisted by the studios. At the time, they were very, very opposed to the new unions forming. But he was under contract at Warner Brothers for many years, made films with, you know, Betty Davis and Humphrey Bogart and Spencer Tracy, and then went on to, yes, as you say, have a career in early television as the sturdy next door neighbor on for many years on Ozzie and Harriet. Our brother Steve was a kid actor on Leave It to Beaver, so they were both going off to, ironically, to kind of create this image of perfect 1950s nuclear family life that both Stephen and David would do a certain amount of critique in later years. But so we had this kind of funny experience of growing up with this older dad, great storyteller, an immersion in American history that he conveyed to us coming from this tiny town in Nebraska that he'd grown up in, and was married to our much younger mom. And the kind of marriage that you never would have thought would have lasted, you know, 26 years younger. She was kind of a sexy young starlet or would-be starlet, but she was actually a really terrific person with a very strong moral compass and a very strong sense of herself. And it turned out to be a great and lasting marriage, and they had four kids. That's a story I tell in my book, but it's the story that David and I lived, and I was the youngest, and ended up going to Berkeley, and then thinking I wanted to be a historian, went ABD from Harvard, studying history, never got my PhD, and segued eventually into journalism, which was kind of where I think I belonged all along, and have had, you know, a pretty long career in magazine journalism, from the New Republic to the New York Times Magazine to the New Yorker, where I've been since 2004.
So. Yeah, 17 years at the New Yorker. That's
a long run.
Yeah. It is. It is. So, how have you experienced the 60s differently? And now I'll let you tell me about your experience of the 60s. What, not just what you did, but what it felt like to you at the time. And as we said, the age difference is 10 years. And then how have your feelings about the 60s and that whole experience changed over time? And just to sort of, you know, keep it bouncing, I'll start again with you, David.
Sure. Well, the 60s and the movement, as we used to call it in those days, for social, political, economic change in America, really was my church. And still is in many ways. The values I share with you, Terrence, that you talked about earlier, are still, I think, guide me today. And the 60s that I was a part of as a foot soldier, not a leader, because I was too young to be a leader in those days. I fought for prisoner rights. I fought against the war in Vietnam. I fought for racial justice. I went to Black Panther rallies. As a foot soldier, was part of many of these different events and struggles. And it really shaped who I was, because I thought that was the best of America, frankly. And the leaders that I thought would lead us to the future in a progressive and sane and just way, one after the other, were killed. John F. Kennedy as president, his brother Bobby, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Fred Hampton. Margaret and I talk about how much of the political violence in America in those years shaped for ill what the country later became. So it took courage, a kind of crazy courage, as Malcolm, as Martin Luther King said, we quote him in the introduction of the book, By the Light of Burning Dreams. It took a kind of crazy courage to be a leader of this movement because it was dangerous. People were shot, people were jailed, people were harassed by the FBI relentlessly and had their lives disrupted in many different ways. And so this courage to change America, fundamentally change it. And I do think it was a revolution. Margaret and I use that term.
Advise. Yeah, we'll ask you to expand on that in a second. Yeah.
I was part of this. I know that what we had in mind from the grassroots on up to the leaders at the top was to fundamentally, radically change the country from what we'd grown up with in the 1950s. And you and I, Terrence, are old enough to remember what America was like in the 1950s. We felt we were building a new America, and we did build a new America in many, many ways. You're right, we didn't take political power and we didn't take economic power. And as a result, we had ended up ultimately with a Donald Trump and the kind of awful situation we have today. But it wasn't for lack of vision. We did have that vision. And so Margaret and I called the book about the 60s and 70s, by the way, By the Light of Burning Dreams, because those dreams still illuminate our way forward. And I really hope that younger people, Margaret and I both have children who are in their early 30s and their 20s. I hope that generation reads our book, finds out about it, and learns from it.
Okay, before I go to you, Margaret, let me say, by the way, I learned a great deal from the book. So as someone who was around lots of those things and certainly contemporary with lots of those things, you only have so much attention, you know? And so I didn't know some of the background of the American Indian movement that I learned, some of the background of the Black Panthers. Really, I mean, I had I had basically gotten, I think, the media representation of the Black Panthers. I felt differently about it than the media maybe wanted me to feel, but I don't think I had the real background of certainly the push-pull that you illuminate. And what you do in the book, as I mentioned before, is you focus on particular leaders, and so that means you focus on particular movements. And I think it's that was really clear, that the same sorts of values and visions were motivating movements all through our culture. Okay, Margaret, your experience as the young sister, the child in the 60s.
Sure, and I'll just say in response to what you just said, Terrence, that I'm really glad that you learned from it, because I do feel like there's been a lot written about the 60s, obviously, but I do feel that, you know, we did a lot of original interviews for this book. And so there is an archival research. And so I do feel like there are fresh insights. Also that we really did, although there are these chapters about different movements, we really looked for and really found a lot of interconnections between these movements that I think people wouldn't necessarily know about. In terms of my own 60s, yeah, I'm 10 years younger. So I, you know, basically was the little sister who tagged along to a lot of anti-war demonstrations, a lot of, you know, our sister, David and our sister Cindy were both undergrads and student activists at UC Santa Cruz. And Cindy was involved in founding the Women's Health Collective there that still exists as a clinic in Santa Cruz, and was very involved in that women's health movement of kind of, you know, taking, you know, issue with some of the medical establishment and taking things into your own hands and doing self-examination and so on and so forth. And so I got a lot of exposure to that at that and just to the counterculture in general at a young age, and felt very intrigued and inspired by it, but of course couldn't really participate at the level that you know, one would if one were older. So it created in me a lifelong curiosity about that movement and an affinity for it. And so, you know, being able to delve into it in this way with David on the book was really so rewarding. It was like a sort of journey back in time, but also to fill in a lot of what I had.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I can see is here at one point there's a 20-year-old David and a 10-year-old Margaret, and he's, you know, he's sharing something and you guys are having a conversation. 50 years later, you come together and say, now let's really, what, you know, let's really go.
That's right.
That just seems like such a treat. Such a treat.
Well, I have to say also, Chance, a shout out to our parents, this crazy, kooky Hollywood family that Margaret writes about so beautifully in her book, The Entertainer. My dad is an old Hollywood actor. My mom is the showgirl that Margaret described earlier. Four kids, all committed to change, to radical change in America. Cindy, the sister that Margaret talked about, who I lived with in the commune at Santa Cruz, later became a very activist doctor, wore to go to Planned Parenthood and do abortions as a doctor, had to wear armor, an armored vest to protect herself against assault. My older brother, Steve, our older brother, did great documentaries for public TV, for Frontline for many years. He's still active doing documentaries. He's doing one right now in the anti-war movement, the Vietnam anti-war movement. So I'm proud of the Talbots. I have to say, the four of us, I don't know why, but we came out of this kooky Hollywood family, and all four of us to this day are still doing God's work, I have to say.
Yeah, right. It wasn't a flirtation. You're all, you found that path and have stayed on it. What did you find? And this is just a quick question. Well, let me go to the one that's a big one, which is, you've already answered the one of why you're willing to call this the Second American Revolution, but I'll give you one more swipe at it, which is, what and who was left out of the first one?
Mark,
David, and then I'll jump in.
In the introduction to By the Library and Dreams, we enumerate the many ways that the first American Revolution both inspired as well as, let down many, many, many Americans, including, of course, African Americans, Native Americans, women, working people, and so on. So it was in many ways an elitist, and right now, of course, I think a new school of history is saying it was a kind of a white nationalist revolution. I think that's going too far. There was a great essay about this recently in the New York Review of Books. But I do think the first American Revolution was woefully inadequate in many ways. While raising people's hopes and dreams, crushed those same dreams after the revolution. And we needed a civil war 100 years later to liberate, Black Americans from bondage. We continue to need, I think, those revolutionary uprisings in America to make America live up to its ideals. And that's the point that Margaret and I make in the introduction. The 60s was another revolutionary period. There's no doubt in my mind that it was a second American Revolution. We wanted to change America across the spectrum in many ways, gender, environment, politics, culture. And all of those areas, we had shock troops trying to change the country. And we built our own radical infrastructure. We built, as Margaret said, women's health clinics, food co-ops that you worked for, Terrence, community gardens, free clothing services. We talk about in the Black Panther chapter, the many ways and many community services the Black Panthers provided their community that were not being taken care of. Everything from sickle cell anemia screening in the Black community to housing to free breakfast programs for kids because they were going to school hungry. There were many ways that Americans were not being taken care of in the 1960s. And we, in radical ways, we being the movement, addressed those. So I'm very proud of how we challenged the power structure and the revolutionary ways we're trying to change this country.
And I would just add to that, one of the themes that was interesting to me was, and kind of underscored this decision to call it the Second American Revolution, was that, you know, while we think of kind of a lot of the iconography and embrace of the founding fathers as being something that I think today we associate with conservatives, with the right, kind of owning that that rhetoric in a way. You know, a lot of the leftists in the 60s, although they were drawing on a lot of strains of thought and were inspired by, you know, movements in third world countries and by socialism and many other ideologies, they were also inspired by the language of the American Revolution and wanted to expand it to people that it excluded in its original iteration, as David says. And even in the gay rights chapter, we talk about how one of the first very brave, you know, open actions by gay picketers was an annual event that would occur at Independence Hall in Philadelphia. It was called the Annual Reminder. It was gay men and women, you know, in the mid 60s, when this was really a very risky and bold thing to do, you know, marching in front of this this monument to America's early history, saying we have been excluded from life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but here we are, and we want to claim it. So, so that kind of turning of the language to their own uses was something we found, and to me was a bit surprising.
Yes, that the Second American Revolution drew on the first.
Exactly.
But one thing you said today, we're recording this on January 7th, so a day after, a year after the Capitol insurrection of January 6th, 2021. And while it may be thought that the right has claimed those early, those founding fathers and so on, clearly the Constitution is now a bedrock of the left and progressives. And actually the one thing that we probably don't have much time to talk about and may not get to is this whole thing of minority rule, which is to me, you know, as big a problem as any that we have, and how we deal with the next couple of years will determine how big a problem it is for the world. But that that the defenders of the Constitution now are not those folks at all, though. Mm-hmm. As you know, I'm sure both of you keep track a little bit of, I'm on a couple of right-wing, you know, email mailing lists. You know, you haven't joined Trump's social media yet. You still have a chance. But they use very much the term "Hello Patriots." I mean, I am addressed when I'm getting my right-wing emails as fellow patriot, and it is so wrong. Let me tell people, by the way, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking today with David and Margaret Talbot. David founded Salon.com. He's written 6 books, including some bestsellers on the Kennedys. Margaret is a staff writer at The New Yorker and has been since 2004. And we're talking about the new book they've written together about the 1960s, By the Light of Burning Dreams. So you guys, I was surprised when I first looked at it. I hadn't read a bunch. I just knew I wanted to read it. by the fact that you choose to structure the book with separate chapters about individual leaders and the movements that they led. And that seems, how easy was that decision and what's behind that decision? And this time I'll start with Margaret.
Okay, well, I will want David to chime in here, because I have to say that the original conception of the book, and he can tell you the story of that, was his. So, but I think, you know, both of us agreed that, you know, although, you know, leaders are sometimes, and leadership is sometimes derided, I think, among all kinds of populist movements, but on the left, the idea that, you know, you'd have hierarchies or elevate any particular people is, you know, it sometimes gets a bad rap. But we felt that, you know, leaders, in fact, are very important, and that although they have to be held accountable, and, you know, they can't, and they obviously have to be in dialogue with the movements constantly, that you need these people. You you need these people, these charismatic leaders, these people who can inspire and who can provide vision and articulate goals. And so we did want to focus on some of those that we thought were most important and tell their stories. And of course, all of their stories are quite dramatic as well. So as storytellers, I think we were attracted to that as well. But David, maybe you want to say more about it since, as I say, it was your baby from the beginning.
Well, I really think that decision was framed, Terrence, by two things. One, it's a much more dramatic way of telling the story by focusing on individuals rather than mass movements. There has been a great, I think, movement among historians to tell history from the grassroots, and that's great and important. And Margaret and I wouldn't deny or reject that school of thought at all. And we don't believe in the great white man theory of history at all, as you can tell from the very diverse group of people that we profile in the book. But we do, as Margaret said, believe in the importance of leadership. And you know what? J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, the police, the forces of repression in this country believed and knew how important leadership was because they kept decapitating.
David, I have to tell you, as Margaret was speaking, I was thinking the next thing I'm going to say, the government obviously thought yes. So.
Well, they killed the Kennedy brothers. They killed Martin Luther King. They killed Malcolm X. And I say they advisedly because they conspired to kill these people. They knew that removing these leaders from these movements was going to have a very destructive impact on the movements. And they did. Tragically. So yes, leaders are important. Other people, like Margaret said, that we profile in the book, were visionaries. Tom Hayden, decades before AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders, believed that you had to fight for economic democracy within the electoral arena. And he ran on a program of economic democracy, which is socialism by any other name, in 1976 when he ran for the primary in here in California for Senate in the Democratic primary. His program was to nationalize energy corporations, was to provide people public health insurance. These were all the programs, the issues that Bernie Sanders later made nationally prominent. And Tom was doing it back in 1976. So these people were ahead of their time. It took, I said, as we say in the introduction, crazy courage to stand up and advocate these things at the time they did. Margaret talked about the gay leaders who bravely were marching back in the mid 60s. We talk about, you know, Dennis Banks. I think I did the last interview with Dennis Banks, who was the co-founder of the American Indian Movement. It was at his 80th birthday party. And Dennis and I had a long talk about Wounded Knee and why that was so important to take a stand on that very desolate prairie in South Dakota on an Indian reservation against really militarized forces, federal marshals, FBI, local sheriffs, vigilantes, who were heavily armed with Vietnam War technology. And they were surrounded quickly, American Indian Movement protesters, when they took control of this tiny hamlet, Wounded Knee, as protest against years and years of federal treachery and really a violation of Native American rights. They took a stand for more than 70 days, sustained 500,000 rounds of ammunition fired at them. Two Native Americans were killed during the siege, but Dennis escaped on the final night. They were probably going to kill him, as they had when they took Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse into custody in a previous century, federal custody. So he was taken by people and his fellow, the Native warriors, and they sneaked out that night in the dead of night. We tell that story. It's a very dramatic story. And Dennis lived to fight another day, which he did till he was 80 years old. And he died when he was 80. So, you know, these are heroes. They're flawed heroes. Marg and I write about their flaws as well. And they have to be held accountable by these movements. But yes, these leaders are important.
You make a point, David, of comparing Occupy and the Tea Party.
Yes.
Just to bring this, you know, fairly close to up to date, Occupy was absolutely horizontal. I attended some meetings. You attended some meetings. You know, it was admirable in some ways. that method of being, the inclusiveness and the lack of hierarchy, but it didn't lead to electoral success at all, though we all agree, I'm quite sure, that it changed the conversation. And when Bernie Sanders talked about the 99% and the corruption of the system, he could ride the wave that the Occupy had done in changing that conversation. But you point out the Tea Party created Congress people.
Yeah,
I mean, we saw on January 6th.
I think you have to compare the left and the right again and again. January 6th, it was the kind of uprising that some radicals back in the 60s imagined them doing, storming the Capitol and so on and so forth. And some of the rhetoric and some of the, I think, rejectionist ideology that the right wing has in this country was taken from the new left and you know, some of the worst aspects of the radical movements of those years, violent and rejectionist. And so partly I'm inspired by that spirit. And yes, it was great that Occupy did change the national dialogue. We changed the conversation, but that's not enough. That falls short again and again. We have to take power in this country. We have to take political power. And the Tea Party did when they started electing people to Congress. That was viable, real change. And this, my church, the Church of the Left, the movement has not had the same ambition. Tom Hayden did. People like Tom Hayden, Bobby Seale, who ran for
mayor. Yes, let me just cut in again. So Hayden, people may know, had that because obviously he served, I think, 18 years in the California legislature. That vision of ignite the people and then run for office and then actually pass the laws. But it was absolutely new to me that Bobby Seale had a similar plan. As I read it, you say you stand up to the brutal cops with your arms, you obey the law, you have studied the law, you are not doing anything illegal, but you are standing up. That ignites the thing. You follow that with community programs, free breakfasts, and all of that, and then you run for office and explain how that got derailed.
Well, that was Bobby's strategy. Exactly right. You capture people's imaginations by confronting violent, brutal cops on the streets legally of Oakland with guns, which is what they did. They immediately, of course, captivated the Black community and the media's attention. And then you pivot right to community programs. You say, here's the things that the community desperately needs. We're going to provide them. And finally, you run for political office because Bobby realized that the budget that he would have as mayor of Oakland was vastly much bigger than anything he could raise as a Black Panther leader. So Bobby did run. Unfortunately, he lost in the early 70s for mayor of Oakland. And then the party was really torn apart, I think, by police repression, by FBI repression, and internally, as Huey Newton, as we talked about earlier, descended more into drugs and violence later became essentially a gang leader. Bobby was driven out of the Black Panthers and the Black Panther Party fell apart. But Bobby's vision, I think, for what radicals should do to take power in this country is still a very viable one and should be studied closely by others who are trying to achieve radical change today.
And although they didn't kill Bobby Seale, by charging him in Chicago and then charging him with contempt and then sending him to prison, they created the vacuum of leadership that Huey Newton and Eldridge Cleaver, with their more radical, less practical, if you will, approach, filled.
And we should let Margaret jump in, but we've been kind of, but yes, and Bobby told me when I interviewed him, they tried to kill him. When they were driving him across country, federal marshals to Chicago to stand trial with the Chicago 8. And by the way, it was not the Chicago 7, it was the Chicago 8, because Bobby was the 8th defendant. Federal marshals at one point told him to get out and run. And he knew he'd be shot in the back. So he'd be shot and killed, escaping injustice. And so Bobby was smart enough not to run, and they took him to jail. But you know, they tried again and again to set these people up and kill them. They killed Fred Hampton, who was the young, charismatic Black Panther leader, in his bed after drugging him next to his pregnant wife. These were death squads, nothing less.
And so, again, we do get back to Margaret and move on. But I just wanted to say that we're making a point of the the government's approach of infiltration and ultimately assassination. And I just want to say that I often feel when people talk about how this country turned to the right and how this country, you know, how Reagan was this huge figure and how everything sort of that we face now kind of unfolded from Reagan, they leave out the fact of the assassinations. You put Reagan up against John or Bobby or Martin, he's just a TV actor.
Yeah.
You take out real charismatic leaders and you make room for someone who's pretending to be a charismatic leader. I think, and when anyone skips that chapter and sort of says, well, the American people didn't actually go that way, did they? You know, we cite the Powell memo. For listeners of this show, know I cite it all the time, but that was the plan to shift business and the Chamber of Commerce and start the Federalist Society and reshape the courts, but to return to business as usual after this upset of the 60s and early 70s, they had a plan. But it's not just the Powell memo and it's not just the Federalist Society. Charismatic leaders are rare. When you end up, as I've already sort of put what I think of Reagan, Clinton rises to the top, not because he's great, but because he's more charismatic than most. You know what I mean? It's like you take the stars off of a team and then you say, and the right beat the bench. Well, that's all they beat.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Margaret.
Where should I dive in?
What I was going to say is that, I'll tell you what, mm-hmm. tell the story of some of the women you feature. And mm-hmm. by that, not just Heather Booth, mm-hmm. but Dolores Huerta, obviously, but even when you're telling the story of Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda, gets a good appraisal in your analysis as being crucial. And you also reassess their role in actually bringing the unending Vietnam War to an end. And Jane's critical to that. And then the women of the Black Panthers are in the day-to-day Black Panthers, it was the women doing the work and so on. So talk about the women in the—
And one woman you left out, Terrence, Yoko Ono, wife of the chapter in John Lennon, former Beatle, and Yoko Ono. I think Yoko politically elevated John Lennon in many ways. And of course they became, I think, very important activists against the war in Vietnam and against Richard Nixon as president.
Yeah,
and I'll just say about that, I was really surprised to learn about that passage of their life and their political activism in and around New York, where they were doing fundraisers and calling attention to the events of Attica for the Black Panthers, and also had a lot of interactions with sort of feminist and other intellectuals. Like they were good friends with Kate Millett, who wrote Sexual Politics. I just had, you know, we were talking about connections before. I had no idea. I loved the documentary Get Back. I watched every minute of it. But it is interesting to see Yoko in it, but of course she's virtually silent throughout it. And to get this other sort of image of her as somebody who was actually, you know, quite articulate and politically engaged as well as, sort of creatively cutting edge is pretty interesting and is very much a part of that chapter. But a couple of things about the women. We were talking about leaders who went astray towards the end of kind of remarkable careers. And unfortunately that happened to Cesar Chavez. I mean, he became very enamored of Synanon, which had started off as a drug rehabilitation group, but as I'm sure many listeners in California know, became a real bastion of thuggery and cult tactics. And he was enamored of their methods and alienated a lot of people he'd worked with closely. Whereas Dolores Huerta has kind of stayed the course, is still around, is still an activist.
Mark and I were interviewed with Dolores recently at UC Santa Cruz event.
Oh, that's great. Right.
She's still, you know, very engaged in contemporary issues, very much wants to talk about this theme of, you know, intergenerational activism, working with younger people and so on. So anyway, in terms of other women, I mean, you know, one of the chapters is focused on the women's movement, and Heather Booth, a remarkable activist who herself is still very active, and her founding of the Jane Collective, which provided abortions. It was an illegal underground abortion service.
This is pre-Roe v. Wade.
Pre-Roe v. Wade, in the late 60s and early 70s, actually started in 1965 out of her dorm room at the University of Chicago, mostly serving students, but went on to serve a lot of low-income Black women in Chicago, people who couldn't afford to go to any of the other states that had legalized abortion, like New York, before Roe v. Wade. And it was provided thousands of abortions with an incredible safety record. They were first using male abortion providers, someone they thought was a doctor who actually wasn't, but they eventually trained themselves to provide the abortion.
They said, if he can do it, we can do it. Yeah.
Exactly, which is truly remarkable. But they were part of, we've been talking about these kind of networks of alternative institutions and organizations and collectives and the vibrancy of those. I mean, the Jane Collective was very much part of this Chicago Women's Liberation Union scene, which had, you know, a rock band and a graphics collective and, you know, provided birth control and had a baseball team and, you know, was just had all and a school and taught, you know, everything from socialist feminism to, you know, how to fix your VW. So they were very much part of that. You know, we are going to model future institutions that could be more egalitarian, that could be more mutual aid, that could sort of, you know, be more organic and emerge out of communities. But I think the Jane, you know, collective was the most remarkable and of course really relevant now because we're probably facing a post-Roe America at the end of this Supreme Court term. And there are a lot of organizations, some of which have been directly inspired by Jane, if they know about Jane, which not everybody does, but you know, that are providing abortion medication to women, that are providing funds to get women to other cities and states where it may still be legal if they are going to be living in states where it is not, and kind of, you know, taking matters into their own hands. So yeah, I mean, and a lot of these women, of course, emerged out of, and a lot of, almost every movement we talk about here has some ties or came out of the civil rights movement in some way. And Heather Booth very much so was in Mississippi in 1964, Freedom Summer. And so many people, you know, learned, developed their organizing chops there, developed their willingness to confront or defy the law if they thought it was unjust. But also in some sense for the women, there were ways in both the civil rights movement and the New Left where they might not have been treated with the equality or dignity that they saw being modeled in other ways and being called for. And so it was that kind of, you know, in that detection of hypocrisy or that detection of ways in which women were not treated, treated equally, by a movement that espoused ideals of equality that gave birth to the women, gave rise to the women's movement. So I guess one of the lessons for me, and I guess it's an obvious one, but it was so striking, is how many people who came into these later movements, anti-war, farm workers, women's movement, gay rights, and so on, had got that crucial training in the civil rights movement, you know, white and Black.
And also, if you've been active in the civil rights movement of that era, you also know the risk you're taking because the government was infiltrating and assassinating them
as well.
Oh, one thing I want to say for people is that when you talk about Heather Booth and the Jane, you, in that chapter, talk about the beginning of the women's movement. When you talk about Craig Rodwell and Pride and the first sort of gay bookstore that wasn't a porn bookstore, right? You talk about all of the emergence of the gay movement. Mm-hmm. So the context, the historical context and themes and so on that you do, each time you get not just the story of this hero or this leader or these few leaders, but you fill out the context. Let me go back to that notion that I mentioned way up front, which is my notion that what we need right now is 60s 2.0. And what I mean is you take the ideals, the visions and so on that motivated the 60s and you see them alive in millennials. They are also, you know, not addicted to consumption. They are also, you know, questioning. I mean, I won't go into it, but we know that millennials and Z and so on have a different take. What I think is different, why I think they have a better chance is technology. We know all the evils of information technology where, you know, if it's free, you're the product. But we also know that you can organize quickly. The demonstrations at the airports after the travel ban took 4 hours. The mobilization took 4 months, mobilization against the war, right? You can communicate. You may think you're the only kid in your little town that feels this way, but no, you go online and you can see you're not, and so on. And also allows us not to materially consume as much because we become more experiential with the technology. The demographics, which is that we were on our own. I say, David, there were 100 beatniks in San Francisco and 100 beatniks in Greenwich Village, but other than that, we were on our own, which isn't quite fair because the civil rights movement was there. But nowadays, there is many of our generation and older who will support younger people. But the third one is the one that you were just talking about, Margaret, which is that the talent pool is so much more enormous now. The leadership back then was mostly male. It was, and unless it was a race-defined organization, it was usually white males. Nowadays, that talent pool, as I say, you just say Greta Thunberg kind of breaks the, you know, breaks the model of what we used to think was a leader. So just quickly, what do you folks think about this idea of an intentionally multi-generational force for change, which I think Third Act, the group that Bill McKibben has recently founded with others, including Jane Fonda and Bernie's part of their promotion, and Bernie Sanders. But I think they are going in this direction. Can we bring our generations in alignment and engagement with young people, and can that tip the scales? Some thoughts, and this will basically, we got about 3 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just quickly say, I mean, I have learned so much from my own children who are in their 20s. My daughter who is gay and queer and identifies as butch, and my son who is older and a young reporter. But I mean, I just feel like their sophistication about a lot of ideas, including about class, is and capitalism and you know, intersectionality, for want of a better word, but the, you know, that we will never again have a, you know, left movement, a progressive movement that is that does not embrace these riches of diversity. And, you know, there's a lot of criticism about cancel culture and so on, and about, you know, how divisive this can be. But it, as you say, Terrence, it can also be so enriching by bringing in all of this talent and all of these perspectives. And of course it's hard to balance them, and it's hard to unite them at times, but there are so many issues like climate change that, you know, supersede all of these divisions, and that, you know, now we see environmentalism as a issue of racial justice as well, in a way that I don't think necessarily people were as attuned to.
Let me just jump in very quickly. I recently interviewed not only McKibben, but also Paul Hawken, right? Mm-hmm. His new book is Regeneration. McKibben's new group is Third Act. Both of them, who have been longtime environmental and climate focused, have stepped back and said, I'm not sure which one of them said it, but he said, if you want people to pay attention to climate change, you have to make them feel you are paying attention to them. And that then becomes economic justice, racial justice, gender justice, and so on. And the fact that we won't succeed successfully confronting those existential crises of pandemics and climate change without bringing all those things together, I think is an interesting recognition on both of their part. David?
Yeah, I think I admire both Margaret and your optimism. I hope that it pans out that way. And I have kids in there who are young, as well as Margaret. They're all friends, by the way, Margaret's kids and my kids. Joe Talbot, my son, my oldest son, made The Last Black Man in San Francisco. He's a young filmmaker in Hollywood. So he's trying to do the next generational work in film.
He combines his father's and his grandfather's work.
That's right. I mean, full circle. So I'm very helpful in many ways. And I remain an optimist at heart. But I do think the left has to get to act together. And I think that's really why Margaret and I wrote the book, By the Light of Burning Dreams. Because as a goad and saying, we need to learn from this history, both us old folks and young folks. And I still think there's too much self-obsession among the younger generation, political purity tests, to the exclusion of taking power. And I think that the radical right is on the move in this country, and the left is not. Yeah. The left is really in disarray. It's trying to figure itself out. The radical right is all about power. They have their leaders, Donald Trump, on down, and they know what they want. They want to take power. And January 6th was a thuggish version of that. So we had to wake up. You know, here in San Francisco, which once was a capital of the left, I've lived here for most of my life now. I wrote a book about Season of the Witch, about the political and cultural tumult that led to so-called progressive San Francisco values. But this city doesn't know what it is. It's like the left in general. It's in disarray. The pandemic, boarded up stores, the mayor who poses as a progressive, a Black woman named London Breed, is all about law and order now. She wants
to clean up the tenderloin. It's her most important thing, right? Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I think the left, as I say, really needs some direction, some inspiration, some leadership now. And so I hope that this diverse group you're talking about does, propel some leaders forward. People who are brave and visionary enough to do what Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy and other leaders of the 60s did, which is to stand up and take the heat and lead us forward, because we desperately need it now. It's not just political crisis we're facing, as you said, it's a climate environmental crisis. It's an existential crisis. And if we want future generations of people to thrive in this country, in this world, we need to really clean up and I think confront capitalism, because capitalism is the evil that we were trying to confront back in the 60s, and we never got that far. And global capitalism is still very much in control when it comes to the environment, when it comes to political leadership, and people posing as populists. If you strip away the power like Trump, you see there's a cabal of capitalists behind them. And again and again, this is, I think, the wizard behind the curtain. If you pull back the curtain, is global capitalism and its power. And I think we have to confront that directly to have the kind of humane and civilized and safe world that we all want.
Yeah, I'm just going to say very, very quickly, because we got it, and then I'll jump to the close. But two of the lessons I think you can learn from your book is, one, leadership did achieve things. You add leadership to this horizontal thing and you may achieve more. And then you also say, and the greatest failure was they did not pursue political power. So if you just take those two lessons, that we got to allow leaders to emerge and use them, but we can't stop short just changing conversations and changing culture. We've got to do the hard work of power. Okay. The book is By the Light of Burning Dreams, The Triumphs and Tragedies of the Second American Revolution. The websites where you can learn more about the authors and the book are harpercollinsoneword.com, The David Talbot Show, The David Talbot Show, all one word.com, and margarettalbot.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, .com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 relevant, timely articles, links to those, sign up at my site or email me at T-E-McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at most of these major podcast sites. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Keanu Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, David and Margaret Talbot, keep up your good work. Thank you.
Thank you very much.